Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Tomorrow marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Later in the hour, we hear from some area residents about their memories of that day. There have been a number of books just released looking back on his life and his presidency, among them the first collection of his letters. The Letters of John F. Kennedy, edited by Martin Sandler, and the book begins, "For many of us, it is almost impossible to believe that more than 50 years have passed since John F. Kennedy entered the White House, the youngest man ever elected president of the United States. It is perhaps even more startling to realize that an enormous percentage of our population has no personal recollection of the man who inspired Americans of all ages, young Americans especially, and captivated the imaginations of people around the world." And Martin Sandler joins us in Woods Hole. Good morning. Good morning. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
All right. So this is, I was really shocked. This is the first book that's a compilation of his actual letters.
I was shocked, too.
50 years later. Wow.
I know. I don't know why. I don't know. And I keep getting asked that. How come? You know, the man is certainly one of the most popular presidents that ever lived. Why in the world has no one done this before? I can only think of that. What idiot's going to sit there and read 3 million letters?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I did not read 3 million letters, but there were 3 million letters, or almost 3 million letters, that went in and out of that White House while he was president for all too short a time. I must have read 700,000 or 800,000, enough to really get the gist. And Mindy, it's my absolute conviction that you can tell more about Kennedy the man, Kennedy the president, and those incredible times he lived in from these letters than from
you.
All the books, because they're human.
Yeah, and it really gives you this insight into him, you know, and you, things that we've forgotten, but you really feel like you get a better picture of who he was as a person. Because if these are letters, of course, written to him and letters that he answers, so you're getting both sides of the conversation.
Yeah, what I say all the time is that thank God there was an email. There was not email.
Yeah, well, all that would be lost.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know about you but or your readers, but, you know, I don't think I've written a legitimate letter, a genuine letter, in 7 or 8 years. I mean, if I was writing this, you know, if you write them now, someone asked me, are you going to do a book on the letters of Obama? No, but I could do a book on the emails or the Twitters of Obama.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk a little bit for people who may be a little bit young and not remember much about John F. Kennedy. He was really the first television president, and it was a perfect showcase for his wit and intelligence in these televised press conferences.
Yes, it was. And you know, most presidents in recent times, they have so avoided having press conferences. They don't want to be put on the spot. Kennedy reveled in it. Now, first, you have to understand, he was movie star gorgeous. He had the quickest wit and loved humor. The press conferences that he gave, and he gave more than any president in history for the time he served, the press conference he gave became the greatest show in town. It was the hottest ticket in Washington. People lined up for hours to try to get into that press room because of the give and take and how he reveled in it. But what's easy to lose sight of, with all of the humor and all of the glibness, he was so in command of the subject. And, in fact, that's what won him the first debate.
Mm-hmm. Right. So he was also an avid reader.
Yeah, 600 words a minute. That wasn't bad.
Yeah.
And an incredible lover of history, and it comes through in the letters in many ways.
Actually, you got your number wrong there, because here I'm writing in your book, Kennedy could read more than 1,200 words a minute.
Mindy, that may be the first time I've ever understated anything in my life.
So before he entered the Navy, he had begun carrying a loose-leaf notebook with him in which he wrote sentences he felt were important to remember.
Right.
While still at Harvard, as an undergraduate, he wrote a thesis that would become a best-selling book, and his second book, of course, earned him a Pulitzer Prize.
What you get from the letters, and you know, there are so many surprises, even for those of us who followed Kennedy for so many years. What you get from these letters is that, you know, he's born with a golden spoon in his mouth. He goes off to Harvard. He's only interested in one thing, conquering women.
Mm-hmm.
And with his looks and his glibness, he did that. And then suddenly his father, between his junior year, his father gets named ambassador to Great Britain. Between his junior and his senior year, his father, the ambassador, asked him to go on a fact-finding trip to Europe. So here is like this 19-year-old kid, and he is interviewing Mussolini, and he's in Hitler's Germany, and he's in England, and he's saying to himself and to some of the British people, Why aren't you preparing? There is a war coming. And he goes back, and now he's not as interested in chasing girls for the moment as he is writing his thesis. And he eventually titles his thesis, Why England Slept, and it becomes a bestseller.
Mm.
I mean, at the age of like 19, yeah. 20 years old. So it's the other thing that one will discover from these letters is that his father gets accused by the leading columnists of the day of being a Nazi sympathizer, an appeaser. And I'm not so quite sure how much of an appeaser he was as that he did not want the United States to go to war. And so Franklin Roosevelt removes him. He comes home and he knows he has to write an article or articles to defend his reputation. It's essential. And who does he turn to? He turns to 20-year-old John F. Kennedy Jr. And in an incredible letter in this book, you see the 17 points that John Kennedy worked out for what his father should say.
Yeah, and there was a gentleness there, too, when he's saying, Dad, I'm not trying to tell you what to do, and I'm not saying you're this, but here's an angle you might want to pursue.
Good for you.
Yeah, and I those letters between Jack and his dad, Joe Kennedy had this, you know, this image and this being, you know, really hard and tough, and there's really a softness there that we see that maybe a lot of people aren't aware, you know, I'm sure in the family they knew that, but on the outside maybe.
That's the magic of letters and the magic of this lost art of letters. I mean, I know, I'm sure we're going to be talking about Khrushchev and Kennedy in a minute or in a few minutes, but the thing is that there's a softness. They hated each other for a long time, and they were determined to crush each other for a long time.
Yeah,
it's not the way it ends. But
no,
that's
because you get to know the human side of somebody.
But you look at these letters, and even, I mean, what I love in these letters, and for your audience in particular, is that one of the letters in the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when they're about to say, we are going to bury you, Khrushchev starts off by saying, I'm sitting at my dacha in the Black Sea. People say Khrushchev cannot relax. That's wrong. Mm-hmm. I relax here at the Black Sea. It allows me to think and to deal with important issues. And when Kennedy writes back, he says, I understand perfectly. He says, I am sitting in Hyannisport, Massachusetts, and I have the Atlantic Ocean in front of me. And so there is a humanness in the letters everywhere, all throughout the book. It's like it allows for a humanness that you don't get on tapes or sound books.
Exactly. All right, so you mentioned more than 2 million letters came in and out of that office in the 1,000 days that he was there. How did you go about compiling what would make it into the book? You said you read maybe 700,000 letters. So did you try to keep with a particular theme, or there were things you were, you know, not interested in? How did you go about that?
Perceptive as usual, Todd. that's exactly how I did it. I said, okay, there are certain topics that I really want to cover. I mean, one of the things, the amazing things that comes out of this, or at least amazing for me, is that this is the youngest president ever elected. Every day he gets up, somewhere around Berlin, something's blowing up. Somewhere in Cuba is blowing up. Mm-hmm. Somewhere all over Europe is blowing up. Every one of the southern states is blowing up in an African-American revolution. And now he's getting hints of this place called Vietnam, which seems like it could be even worse. So you've got all these topics to cover. I also knew that I wanted to talk about his young years. I wanted to talk about the road to the White House. I mean, I knew there were things like, you know, for a long time, it looked like simply because he was a Catholic, he wasn't going to. There had to be a mine. So I did just exactly what you said.
Yeah.
I thought of the topics that I wanted to go. And then I went in, and I must, for example, for the anti-Catholic thing and how he dealt with that in such an incredible way, I probably read 1,000 letters.
Mm.
After a while, I said to myself, okay, I got to cut bait. Yeah. Now, I did television for a long time, and it always killed me when a show came on, because I knew what was on that cutting room floor.
Right.
I know it's still lying in the floor of these letters. But I think I did a good job, and I think that I got the best of them. But that's how I did it.
Yeah. All right. So I think we can all remember the reports of back problems that he had. But he had a lot of health issues beginning in his childhood.
That's the biggest. You know, I could have gone looking for the Marilyn Monroe letters, you know, and said, hey, room 27. And I did not set out to write something sensational. Yeah. I really didn't. But there are things that emerge, and the thing that really surprised me, early on in the book, in one of the introductions, I talk about the fact that he wrote to one of his friends and said, I'm 35 years old now, and I've just come from the doctors, and they told me I probably won't live beyond 45. Because he had, you know, they covered it up, but he had Addison's disease so badly that wherever he traveled in Europe, the family had already planted the steroids and the other kind of drugs in every major city so that they could tend to him. To his enormous, I mean, one of his colleagues in one of the letters, one of the colleagues writes that you know, he was a walking pharmaceutical store, you know. But that...
You'd never know it, though.
No, that's to his incredible credit. It never seemed to affect one day of his presidency.
But as a kid, too, he seemed to come down with scarlet fever, all these crazy things, one after another. I mean, I guess Rose would keep cards because she had so many kids, to keep straight who had what, you know, back before we had the digital stuff we have today. And his card was pretty full.
He had a whole file box. I've seen them. It's wonderful. In the Kennedy Homestead in Brookline, which is a National Historic Site now, you can go in and you can actually see. And there's a small file box for Rosemary and a small file box for Eunice and so forth. And then there's this enormous file box of Kennedy. And another one of the letters you discover that he once wrote to Robert saying that if they ever write the story, this is when he was like 18, if they ever write the story of my life, it'll be entitled The Medical History of John F. Kennedy.
Right? We're talking with Martin Sandler, who edited the letters of John F. Kennedy. Youngest president, as we mentioned, ever elected, and that youth was an issue for him in the campaign. There's a lot of great letters in the campaign. Hubert Humphrey told him to grow up and stop acting like a boy. Eleanor Roosevelt referred to him as my dear boy. And Lyndon Johnson joked about John F. Kennedy having received a glowing medical report from his pediatrician.
Exactly right. And the letters, the exchange of letters between Kennedy and Eleanor Roosevelt are particularly
Are great.
They're wonderful because, first of all, she wanted Adlai Stevenson. That was her man. But secondly, she was convinced he was much too young, and most important, she was absolutely convinced that Joe Kennedy Sr. was attempting to buy the presidency for her father, for him. And so there's this enormous correspondence that goes back and forth because he needs her. He doesn't need her.
He knows she's powerful.
The most powerful woman in the whole world. And he doesn't need her to stand up and say, vote for John Kennedy. But he certainly cannot, he just can't afford to her to stand up and saying, do not vote for John Kennedy. And it's wonderful. There's a side thing that I put in one of my brilliant introductions, and modest introductions, in which I talk about him appearing at the press club. And he appears at, this is one of the most important places he could speak, and he knows he's going to be asked about this whole charge of his father trying to, and so he takes out a blank piece of paper, but the audience can't see that, the press can't see that it's blank. And he says, well, it's interesting. He said, I just got a telegram from my father, and it says, let me read it to you. It says, John, I'll be glad to buy you a victory, but I'll be damned if I'll pay for a landslide. You know, but it's so perfectly
it's
Kennedy.
Again,
it's so perfectly Kennedy.
Well, I really like those letters between him and Eleanor because in the beginning, you sense the tension. You know, she's got a point of view. He's got a point of view. He's trying to be polite, but he doesn't want to be a pushover either. And then she's going, a little bit, you know, sometimes not real happy with what he's written. But again, and then they sort of eventually have this friendship that forms out of and respect.
Well, it's, you know, what I say in that, it's one of the earliest signs of how he was able to work with people. I mean, you know, to she was no shrinking violet.
No, that's for sure.
And for him to win her over, you know, it's wonderful. Through the letters you get in the book, you can actually see how it evolves. The last letter you get between them is from them. One of them is Eleanor thanking him for nominating her for the Nobel Prize.
Right.
You know, and even in that the campaign, she worked for him. I mean, once Stevenson wasn't going to make it.
Right. Yeah. Well, and then the other issue that you mentioned, touched on a minute ago, was the fact that he was a Catholic.
Oh boy, that you know it's an extraordinary. You know, in an earlier book that I did on the Kennedy Through the Lens that you and I talked about quite a while ago, one of the things that I was so, you know, I just featured that you look at a picture of Hillary Clinton campaigning against Barack Obama, and you realize how far we've come. With all the problems we've come, with all the compromises we can't seem to reach, you're looking at a woman being a legitimate candidate for president, and you're looking at an African-American being a legitimate, in fact, he wins.
Right.
much of that is due to John Kennedy. You know, we had one Catholic candidate before Al Smith, and they savaged him. It's hard for us to believe in 2013.
Right. Yeah, I can just see some of the younger kids going, what are you talking about?
Yeah. Well, yeah, and you know, we talked about when did you know you read enough letters on a topic? It was very hard to get out of the Catholic ones, anti-Catholic ones, because they're so vituperative. They're so incredible. Mm-hmm. I mean, letters coming from high places saying, you think I'm going to vote for you and let the Pope tell me what to do?
Right, but he handled this very well. I mean, really.
From the beginning.
Yeah, I loved when and I'm paraphrasing here because I don't have it in front of me, but something to the effect of, I don't expect a Catholic to vote for me because I'm Catholic, as I don't expect a Protestant to vote against me because
exactly
I'm
right. He,
not a Protestant.
You know, the first time it came up was before even the campaign when he was running for Congress. As a young, skinny candidate, and they asked him about the Catholic thing, and he hadn't even prepared anything. I think it was his first rally in South Boston, and somebody said, "You think we're going to vote for a Catholic?" And he stood up and he looked the guy in the eye and said, "Nobody asked my brother if he was Catholic when they put him in a plane and blew him up for the sake of this country." You know, but the letters. What's very, very important about these letters? What's really important is that more than the speeches, more than anything else, it's the letters from other people to him on certain issues like the Catholic thing, like Vietnam, that force him to sit down and say, okay, let me articulate what my position is. And it's in the letters that he writes in reply to ministers and private citizens who are saying, we can't vote for you because, or why do you think we should vote for you if you're a Catholic? It's there that he talks so articulately about church and the separation of church and state, or that I will adhere to the Constitution, not to the Vatican.
You know, it's interesting. Recently, we did a conversation, a panel discussion somewhere, where we were talking about Abraham Lincoln, and I can't help but make some comparisons here on their speech writing and just how articulate the humor and
that's
the wit.
Right.
It's really fascinating,
right.
You know, completely obviously different times, but you wrote a book about Abraham Lincoln because he was, you know, really the first, where we'd say John F. Kennedy was the first television president. Abraham Lincoln was
the first president to be photographed.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And the other thing they both had in common. The thing is, they both have this enormous sense of history and their place in history.
Yeah.
They really do. Kennedy was aware of his place in history from day one. And it guided and shaped their presidency.
Yeah. We are discussing the letters of John F. Kennedy, edited by Martin Sandler. More after a quick break.
Well, I'm a carpenter. You know, I spend most of my time working on houses to make a living. But when I work on a boat, I really feel like I'm doing something that satisfies me deep down in my soul. Everything that you do on a boat is challenging. They're all curves. They're steam bending. Plus, they're so visual. You know, they're so beautiful. And I've always had a passion for boats my entire life, as long as I can remember. Everyone should have a passion in life, and mine is boats, I guess. And dogs. I like dogs a lot. I'm Carlo D'Antonio. You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
You are listening to The Point, and we're discussing the letters of John F. Kennedy, edited by Martin Sandler. You include some letters from kids. And there's one here that I really got a kick out of, and it's a little bit long to read, but this is the little boy who says, in view of the fact that the presidential elections are being held in November, my sixth grade class decided to elect a president from the list of potential candidates. Mm-hmm. The first straw vote, the outcome was not good. Kennedy, he got like two votes.
Right.
And so this kid, it was our teacher, Mrs. Mendelson, asked for volunteers to head each candidate's campaign, and I volunteered to head yours. We were allowed four posters. 2 weeks later, we had the arguments on who was the best man for president. After the arguments, we voted for a president. And wouldn't you know, Kennedy wins that one. Are you and Mr. Nixon, he says, oh, you, as you and Mr. Nixon were fairly close, we decided to vote again between you two. And again, Kennedy came out on top. He writes, good luck with your primaries. And of course, you said, one can only imagine the pride that Kennedy's response endeared into a young Mr. Apley, because he calls him, what, his first campaign manager?
He said, thank you for being here. I am so lucky to have a campaign manager such as you. Yeah, the letters from the young people are extraordinary, and they're not only charming, but they're so perceptive.
Right. Well, yeah, and you know, as you read some of these responses, you think you can see the wit coming through. But a staff member would do that in most cases.
Oh, yeah,
you know? You wouldn't expect the president to be answering these letters.
Maybe it's one time in the whole day that he can have some fun with something. Yeah, I mean, really, I mean, with what he's dealing with, and it got to him. I mean, these letters and. You know, the letter from the young one, a 9-year-old who tells him that after John Glenn lands and the whole world is so proud, and he writes back and says, Mr. President, I am so proud of John Glenn, as is everyone. But would you please tell me this? Why are we spending so many millions?
Right.
If God wanted us up there, he'd have put us up there.
Yeah.
There are people who are starving. There are people in such great need. Please, why will you answer me why we're not spending the money that way? This is a 9-year-old kid.
I know, really, the insight in some of these kids' letters. So in his acceptance speech, he used the term New Frontier, and a theme that he repeated on the campaign trail. And boy, oh boy, did he have some ideas. I mean, you mentioned the space race. And
there's never been a president of the United States who has inspired so many people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and of course, and his legacy continues of that. You know, the Peace Corps has been one of the great governmental successes. I mean, it's had its problems, but it's been one of the most extraordinary governmental successes. And all the way through, he's not just inspiring young people. Some of these letters in which his pet project, and I make it sound trivial by saying a pet project, the thing he wanted most was to achieve in his lifetime a nuclear, even more than space, he wanted to achieve a nuclear test ban treaty.
Right.
And he did it.
And he did, yeah.
And you read those letters between how he's enlisting his great friend, Harold Macmillan, the Prime Minister of England, how they're trying to avoid even involving de Gaulle because he knows he'll try to ham it up and take over the show. But and how he wins Khrushchev over and how he has to continually fend off letters from people like Linus Pauling, who is one of the best-meaning leaders of the peace movement, but who's writing him saying, if you don't move right now, we're going to blow up.
Right.
It's going to be your fault, Mr. President. He has to deal with all of that, but he achieves it, and it's a crowning achievement.
Of course, the space race thing, he really wanted to beat the Soviet Union.
Yes,
he wanted to be the first one. And I love this, as we talk about this developing relationship between him and Khrushchev. Khrushchev sends a puppy, which I love, Pushinka, who is the puppy from
Russian sent
that they
up
had
in space.
Sent up in space. So that's kind of like, it's a nice thing, but is it also kind of, we were, you know,
we're not.
Exactly.
That's right.
But yeah,
that's right.
But that, just as you go through the letters, through the book between the two of them, you really see this amazing relationship develop, as you say in the beginning, and there's some very tense, as we know, tense letters between them, but there really becomes this mutual respect for each other.
It does, and what's for me, you know, I have a thesis, as all authors should, as going into this book. And it's a conviction that, as I said to you before, I really think you can tell more about Kennedy, the man president, and his times through the letters.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing verifies that more than when Kennedy and Khrushchev mutually decide, look, we are very angry with each other. We hate each other at moments. The world is about to blow up because of this confrontation over these missiles. We have got to agree that we will write to each other every day, that we will have these letters delivered secretly in diplomatic pouches so the press can't get a hold of them and ruin it.
Yeah, that was interesting how they decided to do it in secret. Yeah.
Well, it never would have worked.
Yeah.
Never,
you know, they couldn't be honest. Yeah.
You're talking to a historian, so forgive me. But, you know, we never would have had a Constitution of the United States if those who deliberated the Constitution of the United States hadn't agreed never to let the press see it until it was done.
Yeah.
Never.
Yeah.
Never would have had a Constitution. Yeah. We'd still be looking to shut the government down. But anyway, that's a side of thing is that they mutually agree that they will write these letters, that they'll keep these informed. You know, there are all kinds of theories as to how did Kennedy save the world from blowing up. P.S. Kennedy and Khrushchev saved the world from blowing up. There's a greatest line that comes out of those 30 letters that were written. The greatest, most memorable line is, if we don't solve this in the next few days, the living will envy the dead. Mm-hmm. That's not Kennedy.
Yep.
That's Khrushchev.
Yep.
And yet, it's through these letters that they finally come to some kind of an understanding. And Kennedy's smart enough to give Khrushchev enough space to save face, but it's the letters that do it. And so, anyway.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, in their first meeting, you know, Khrushchev kind of takes advantage of this young guy.
Oh, he bullied him.
He
savaged him.
Doesn't know what he's doing.
That's
and,
right.
Yeah, so it's interesting to, as I say, watch the progression of their relationship over the years. And, you know, I was a kid when this was going on, but I remember that threat of nuclear war being pretty scary. You remember all the magazines with the build the bomb shelters and schools?
When you read this brilliant book and you see the letter from John Galbraith in which he's responding to Kennedy's request to have him look over this brochure, about how to build a bomb shelter, you know, Kennedy wrote to every one of his relatives saying, have you built your shelter yet?
Mm-hmm.
And Kennedy authored this huge article. He authored it. The President of the United States authored this huge article on how to build a bomb shelter or why you have to have a bomb shelter for Life magazine. And Galbraith's writing back and saying, you better not, please, Mr. President, don't let this brochure be published. They've written a brochure shows how the rich can save themselves while all the rest of us can die.
So
you're right on, of course.
Well, and of course, what goes through a kid's mind? This is actually a cute. A little girl had written a letter, and so this is the president's response to her. Dear Michelle, I was glad to get your letter about trying to stop the Russians from bombing the North Pole and risking the life of Santa Claus. I share your concern about the atmosphere. Testing of the Soviet Union, not only for the North Pole, but for the countries throughout the world, not only for Santa Claus, but for the people throughout the world. However, you must not worry about Santa Claus. I talked with him yesterday, and he is fine. He will be making his rounds again this Christmas.
But
you know, you can see this child has got, she's seriously concerned, and he's allied her fears. At the same
time. Right.
Yeah. I mean, he's.
Yeah. And so clever.
Yeah. He was very clever. All right. So, physical fitness was also an important aspect of the president. He launched a massive public awareness campaign. Remember,
one of the parts of the Kennedy program that's really gone unnoticed. You know, I didn't know about it.
Until we start seeing all the gym classes cut from schools.
Yeah,
right?
But you know, yeah, exactly. But I also talked to a lot of people who remember back being part of that program and so forth. He took that very seriously, too. And it was, again, another true success. Although, the letters from kids, you know, one writing saying, Mr. President, it's great that you did that, but you know, how come our teachers are so fat and pudgy and you're asking us to get in shape?
Right, another girl who wrote, the boys get the use of the gym. We can't use it. Why can't we play basketball? I know she was asking for girls to have.
And the other girl who writes and says, how do you expect us to do it in the kind of shoes we
I know, I have this way. This was great. Yeah, she said, how can we do it with the deformed feet because all the shoes were pointy? And she said something about, you know, you wouldn't expect your military to hike 50 miles in pointy shoes. But I love that she says, I have written letters to newspapers and shoe manufacturers without success, but the solution is simple for you. Please convince Mrs. Kennedy to buy and wear in public round-toed shoes.
That's
and
right.
Every style-conscious woman will demand the manufacturers make
them. Particularly Jackie. I think she wore got emulated.
That's right, for sure. Exactly.
That's right.
And then, of course, we have the Peace Corps initiative, which really inspired a lot of young people, and you touched on that already.
Yeah,
but that,
he was, as I said, starting with, particularly with the inaugural address, which still remains one of the great inaugural addresses in history, and written by him. Mm-hmm. He was the most inspiring guy. He was innately inspiring.
Yeah.
And I remember being so inspired just looking at that television set and my eyes opening. Did he really say that? And did he say it that way? It was wonderful. And this whole idea, I mean, you know, it's one thing to say, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And yet it's something else again to say to young people, we're not going to pay you, really.
Yeah.
And we're going to send you in harm's way. But what could be better? When he finished the inaugural address, and then when he inaugurated the Peace Corps, young people entering government service went up by 150 times.
Yeah.
I mean, we haven't had that.
Exactly. We're talking with Martin Sandler, who edited The Letters of John F. Kennedy. We forget, too, how intense the civil rights struggle was at this time. Mm-hmm. And while some thought the president's slow, cautious approach was fine, there were mm-hmm. others who were criticizing him about it, Jackie Robinson being one in particular.
Yeah, the letters that come into the White House, that come into him personally, from the Jackie Robinsons, from the A. Philip Randolphs, from the James Farmers. Those are the most vituperative letters of all. And they're saying it's okay for you to say, sitting in Hyannis Port on the Honey Fitz, wait, your turn will come. We're not going to wait anymore. Not when our children are getting... I mean, they're really very, very angry mm-hmm. letters. And Kennedy's, you know, he's got a problem. He's a politician.
Right.
And yet he's, of course, in favor of human rights. He's certainly in sympathy with the African-American movement. But he knows he wants to be reelected, and
yeah.
he's a political animal. And that's very difficult. And it's only when suddenly George Wallace stands in that doorway
right.
and Kennedy looks and says, my God, we've outlawed segregation. We've sent troops and marches, and he's still doing that. That suddenly something snaps.
You got to stand up.
Yeah. And he sits down and he says, I intend to send, he gives an address to the country saying that he intends to send the most far-reaching civil rights legislation in the history. You know, it's time. And when he finishes that speech, and he turns to one of his aides and he says, why is it that sometimes it takes us so long to do what we know we should have done so
yeah.
long ago?
Right.
And Martin Luther King, of course, then writes to him immediately and says that's the greatest right. greatest legislation in history.
Right. But, well, the letters from Martin Luther King are interesting, too,
yeah.
because, of course, another fabulous man, Martin
yes.
Luther King. So, but, yeah, and what was going on in Alabama, Birmingham,
yeah.
And President Kennedy helping to try to get him. And there was a nice letter where... the president had called Martin Luther King Jr.'s wife
right.
To sort of console her while he was,
well, he was put in prison.
Yeah.
And there are some that just tear your heart out. I mean, one of the Jackie Robinson letters talking about, written right after Medgar Evers is killed in mm-hmm. front of his wife and children in his own driveway, and saying, Mr. President, if you don't give some protection to Martin Luther King, we're going to have as big or bigger tragedy, mm. and then we know what happened.
Right.
So that it just breaks your heart.
Yeah.
It really does. And Kennedy, you know, admitting, I waited too long. Now, could he have reversed events? I'm not so sure about that. But on the other hand, you know, as a historian, I always say you have to try to put yourself back in the times.
Right.
And it's
yeah.
very hard.
Well, that's one of the things I felt reading this. It's, you know, as time changes, you know, things change, you forget. I mean, I remember the riots. I remember how intense and
yeah.
the anger and the yeah. upheaval throughout the country. And you know, when you go back and reread some of this stuff, it just sort of brings you right back there to, you know,
yeah, and
how
I think
tough
that's,
the times were.
I think that's an important contribution of books like this. I think of all the books because we what I like to say is that sometimes I go into the classroom and I teach, and we got students who are in college now think Kennedy and Thomas Jefferson were contemporaries.
Mm.
I mean, you might as well say, you know, you might as well say Jefferson as say Kennedy. I mean, they're that far removed
right.
from it. And you and I, God, we remember, so many of us remember in sort of awe.
Yeah.
But, man.
All right. I'm reading from the book here. When I ran for the presidency of the United States, John Kennedy stated, I couldn't realize how heavy and constant would be the burdens. And no wonder, no American president ever faced a greater array of major challenges or more potentially catastrophic crises than
That's
did
right.
Kennedy. We got to remember, again, this was 3,500 days, 3.5 years,
That's right.
that all of this happened in
and
such a short time
And he's
frame.
A baby. I mean,
yeah.
you know, he's not 46 years old.
Yeah.
And you're right. And I like the way in so many of the people of the day, the important people of the day, when they're writing to him, you know, Bernard Baruch saying, Mr. President, first let me say that no president has ever faced the burdens that you've faced. Mm-hmm. Or Herbert Hoover, who's now over 90 years old, saying, Mr. President, you are facing more obstacles than any president in our history, whatever I can do for you. And over again, mm-hmm. they recognize this. It's an incredible. Thank you for picking that quote, because he recognized, he couldn't recognize going in how mm-hmm. great right. the burdens would be.
Yeah, and then of course we have the beginnings of the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. And he's conflicted there as well. Oh. Walter Cronkite did an interview with him in Hyannisport where they talked about that. And
that's
you know
right.
that in that interview he was basically saying it's their war.
That's
you know,
right. That's and, right. You know, the way I set that up with the letters, because what I was. What I was just so taken with was the conflicting advice he mm-hmm. got. He, you know, he was wonderful at being, well, he was Kennedy, he was John Kennedy, and he was wonderful at being able to attract the greatest minds, you know, I mean, you know, he's the one who said, it's the greatest collection of minds since Thomas Jefferson sat in this room alone. But that aside, and he's also the one who said, advisors are great. They give you all the greatest advice in the world, and then they go off to their other stuff. But, and you take, you face it. But he had, there are those who are saying, we've got to be involved. It's going to be a domino. We're going to wind up on our doorstep. We've got to blow them up. And there are others saying,
don't get caught in this
quagmire. Don't get caught in it. And it's, you know, it's one, I love to play what ifs. As a historian, you know, what if the South had won the Civil War? What if Kennedy had lived? Probably the greatest political conundrum of our lifetime and beyond is what if Kennedy had lived and what would he have done about Vietnam? People have asked me, okay, what are your favorite letters in here? Certainly one of my favorite letters is the one that comes in from Bobby Lou Pendergrass, who in effect says, my oldest brother got killed in World War II. My second oldest brother got killed in Korea. They were real heroes. We treat them as heroes. We are so proud of them. We knew where they were fighting and what they were fighting for. Now we've gotten this telegram saying our youngest brother has been killed in a place called Vietnam. We don't know where Vietnam is. We certainly don't know why we're fighting there. Mm-hmm. I admire you, Mr. President, but would you please tell me what in the heck are we doing there?
Yeah, that was a moving letter, yeah.
Oh, yeah, and maybe it's certainly one of the first protests, mm-hmm. Vietnam protests. And more important, or just as important, I don't know of any place, and man, did I do research in other books, I don't know of any other place where he so articulately and so directly explains why he sent advisors in there mm-hmm. than in the response
yeah,
to her.
Yeah.
So that
he was very thoughtful, but also explained, you know, exactly what,
exactly.
What he was thinking.
And he was going out the door, as it says in this book, on his way to this place called Dallas, when he asked one of his aides to prepare a report that he wanted on his desk when he got back, listing the most cogent reasons why we should pull out.
Mm.
Now, would he have done it? We just won't know.
We are discussing the letters of John F. Kennedy, edited by Martin Sandler. More after a quick break.
Right now, WCAI is running the 4 for Feb Challenge. 400 gifts made before the end of the year, and February will go fundraiser-free. Full details at capeandislands.org.
You are listening to The Point, and we're discussing the letters of John F. Kennedy, edited by Martin Sandler. We didn't touch on the Berlin Wall went up during, or it begins again.
Yeah. And
that was another tense relationship.
Well, it's not only a tense relationship. Yeah, it's a tense relationship, and he winds up with having Willy Brandt very angry at him for a while because what he makes very clear is that he is not going to put the United States into war over Berlin. Mm-hmm. He knows damn well that it's a terrible issue, a terribly difficult issue, and he's outraged, of course, and he knows he has to draw a line in the sand somewhere with the Russians, but not over Berlin. He won't do it. And yet, because he's Kennedy, he winds up giving his Berlin Wall speech, which is one of the great speeches of all time, mm-hmm. and Willy Brandt is like praising him up the, you know, right after, mm-hmm. right after the speech. So it's William Manchester, who may have been the most articulate before me. No, way before and after me, William Manchester may have been the most articulate of all the chroniclers of Kennedy, and he had the advantage of being a close personal friend and was with him all the time, you know. He says that, you know, his death was one of the great tragedies in our history, mm-hmm. but his life was a triumph.
Right.
And nobody seized
that's a good point.
Yeah, nobody seized upon opportunities like Kennedy. It's very interesting. I was talking to the BBC earlier this morning, and one of the women said, you know, the early reviews on your book are glowing, although it just in like one line, somebody said, maybe you were being too nice to Kennedy. Well, you know, too glowing about Kennedy or too positive mm-hmm. about Kennedy. I plead guilty. I mean, I can't help it. I mean, mm-hmm. as a historian, of course, you want to err on the side of objectivity. But it's very hard. I mean, we knew what his warts were. Right, and I mean, believe me, if he would live today with his sexual shenanigans, God knows what would have happened to mm-hmm. him politically.
Yeah.
But he lives at a different time mm-hmm. when that stuff was not fodder for the press. But the way he handled himself and what you know, you read that, you study that, you study the physical burden that he carried mm-hmm. with the pain. You studied the emotional burden, and it was a bigger one than most people realize when his son died. People mm-hmm, say right. that changed him forever. you read all that, and you cannot help but come away just so proud that this man was once the president of the United States.
Exactly. And just going back to that day he left for Dallas, and again, we forget— this was not, I mean, there were a lot of people who warned him, don't go.
Oh,
this is
man.
Not a. This is not a city where you want to be driving
no,
in the streets in this convertible. People are angry and,
that's
you know.
Right.
Yeah,
that's
it
right.
Was, he knew he was going into a tough situation.
And he had the, Mindy, he had the evidence of Adlai Stevenson having gone like 2 weeks before
right.
and getting spit on and hit with placards. And there were crazies down
mm-hmm.
there, you know. But we also forget that you never can lose sight of it. He's a political animal mm-hmm. as well. He wanted Texas in that win column for the, right. for the 1964 election. And 1964 election. And he was determined to do it. And boy, did he get warned.
Yeah, I was saying, and you also have to wonder, going back to his days in the Navy, you know, when that PT boat went down, and thinking, hey, I survived that. You know, I mean, that was a miracle.
Yeah, good for you. I didn't think of that.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah, so, you know, when you're especially with, you know, danger, war situations, and you think, how bad could it be? I was in the war, you know?
Exactly. They cut me in. And that's one of the other great letters in the book, where he gets a letter from the Japanese mm-hmm. commander who was on the bridge. When that apologizing, saying we didn't intend to do that,
it just happened. You were there. They came around the corner,
yeah,
so to speak,
you were there.
And there you were.
Yeah, now that you're president, I apologize.
Exactly. So, as we mentioned, some of the events that occurred during his presidency: the Bay of Pigs invasion, Cuban Missile Crisis, the race to land on the moon, the Civil Rights Movement, the building of the Berlin Wall, and the beginnings of the Vietnam War, the nuclear test ban treaty. There, as we said, a lot going on in there. And before we let you go, I have to ask about the photos. Did you have to get certain like permissions for the letters the photos, or because they're all in the Kennedy Library, were you able to, I mean, how did that work?
Well, the photos, many of the photos I got, I had done that earlier book, so I had really started to really dig into the photos, and there's so many great photographs in the John F. Kennedy. And if they're in the John F. Kennedy, you know, Kennedy was so aware of his image, mm-hmm. his sense in history. He is the president who first appoints an official White House
That's
photographer.
Right, yeah.
And all of that stuff is good. But there were a lot more other photographers, too. So
mm-hmm.
The letters are a different story. The letters, about 90% of the letters I used are in the Kennedy Library Museum. But there are others from all over the world and mm-hmm. in other archives. Letters written by Kennedy reside in the Kennedy Library, and I did not have to go get special permission for mm-hmm. that. But letters that are written to Kennedy, those are the copyright domain mm-hmm. of the people who write them. And so that's a huge job. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's another reason why there hasn't been another book
maybe.
Written.
Yeah, I'd you know, about that, yeah.
What we did is thank God for the word disclaimer. You know, we have a statement in the book that says every attempt has been made to contact every person who wrote a letter for this book. And if someone sees one now and they don't want it, let us know.
Right.
That's common practice, yeah. But we didn't just give lip service to it. We wrote, and we wrote, and we wrote. A lot of the people are very hard to find. I mean, it's over 50 years ago.
And you do have one of his favorite photos in there, which is in the Oval Office with Caroline and Little John.
Oh, that is his favorite. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think everybody can drop those images in their head.
Oh, yeah, and what he did is, you know, the White House press photographer who he had appointed, Mrs. Evelyn Lincoln, who was his secretary, had a button under her desk. And when she peeked in at sometimes, I heard laughter, and she saw it was a great photo op, she just pushed the button, and the photographer came running.
Oh, that's funny.
Oh, yeah. So they you know, they were very, very aware of it.
Yeah.
And that's what made him such a great television
person. I know this was a lot of work for you. Did you enjoy doing it? It seems like you really enjoyed doing this book.
I did. Mm-hmm. I love doing research. And reading letters is a lot easier than reading the Treaty of Paris in 1983. And it's a very human.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a big detective hunt. It's just very, very time-consuming. The negative side of it is I have the patience of a gnat, so that I just try to rein myself in and say, look, it's going to take time. And you have to go. The maddening thing, we touched upon this. The maddening thing is you're always asking yourself, what am I leaving out? You know, I was doing television for a long time, and I always would watch the show and say, yeah, I'm proud of it, but if they only knew what was on that cutting room floor, you know, if they only knew what other letter. And what they got to do is buy this book like crazy so I can do volume 2.
All right. With that, Martin Sandler, editor of The Letters of John F. Kennedy. Thanks so much for being here, Martin.
Oh,
it's always
good to see you. It's always a pleasure. Thank you.